The Tom Woods Show, episode 1805.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this special episode of The Tom Woods Show that will consist of a discussion between two eminent scholars, Dr. Martin Kulldorff and Dr. Eric Topol. They will be discussing the optimal public health approach to the challenge posed by COVID-19. We're going to do something a little bit different in this discussion. Each participant will have an opportunity for an opening statement, laying out his position, and then each will respond to the other's statement. And after that, I will disappear into the background entirely and allow these two gentlemen to ask questions of each other and continue the discussion. Once the conversation appears to have run its natural course or a certain amount of time has passed, I will reemerge and give each person the opportunity for a final word. I want to be as impartial as possible, so the biographical information I will read was supplied by the participants themselves. Dr. Martin Kulldorff is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. His research centers on developing new epidemiological and statistical methods for the early detection and monitoring of infectious disease outbreaks and for post-market drug and vaccine safety surveillance. Dr. Eric Topol is a professor of molecular medicine at Scripps Research, founder and director of its Translational Research Institute, a practicing physician, and one of the top 10 cited medical researchers. So, let's turn now to our opening statements. Dr. Topol, because I've taken pretty strong public stances in support of Professor Kulldorff, as a gesture of goodwill, I would like to give you the opportunity to decide whether you would prefer to go first or second.
I'm happy to go first. That'd be okay. Fine.
And you, each of you, and I forgot to mention, instead of debating one resolution, instead what we've done is each participant has developed his own resolution, in effect, a statement of his particular position that he will then proceed to defend. And I have those that I can either read or the participants can read.
If you could read mine, that would be great, Tom.
Professor Topol's position is, everyone needs to be protected from COVID-19 infections and can be without the use of lockdowns. All right, Professor Topol.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks, Martin, for having a chance to discuss this important topic with you. I was joshing with Tom yesterday in a note that I feel like I'm coming into the lion's den because I know the listeners of his podcast lean very much away from the view that we need to protect everyone and are very much in favor of the focused protection and the Great Barrington Declaration that you, Martin, and colleagues put together back in October and published. I think there are some issues, though, that need to be grappled with. The first I'd like to get into is that I think the views of the Barrington Declaration are very much death-centric. That is, their focused protection, trying to have the elderly or those who are most prone to dying be put in a separate compartment and protected. But the problem is that the young people, and here we're talking about people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, who get mild COVID, some even asymptomatic, at worst moderate, are the worst risk for long COVID. There are many papers published on this. At least 10 to 20% of people who get COVID infections have long-term sequelae. And in fact, recent papers suggest that goes on well into 7 or 8 months, is debilitating. At least half don't get back to work and or return to their normal baseline activities before they got an infection. So the idea of focused protection for the people at risk, high risk, particularly the aged, doesn't take into account the morbidities of long COVID. Moreover, the 41-year-old who died yesterday, the Republican Congressman Luke Letlow, who had just been elected, is an example of people who die young. And the point is, because this is such a disseminated infection throughout the world and particularly in the United States, we have young people dying. And because it's so, the denominator is so big, even though it may be a very small fraction, it adds up to a lot of numbers of people. And in addition to that, you know, we have on the front page today of the New York Times, a 51-year-old man who was previously healthy, who's been hospitalized 7 times, and a review of readmissions to the hospital without dying, whereby it's 10 to 20% in multiple series. So the morbidity is missed by this great Barrington Declaration of Focused Protection. I hope I can get that point across. The second issue is about herd immunity, natural herd immunity. Today, Vox, the website, puts it out as the worst idea of 2020. Natural herd immunity has never been established, That is, it's relied, all infections of viruses have required a vaccine. So to think that COVID would be the first one to establish natural herd immunity is just not based on data. And the country that's most simulated the plan of the Great Barrington Declaration was Sweden. And Sweden has done extremely poorly. And in fact, the idea of focused protection there has resulted in the largest numbers of deaths of Sweden in 150 years. And now very close to the U.S. in terms of the U.S. now is 1 per 970 people who have died. And in Sweden, it's 1 in 1,140. These are very bad outlier statistics. Only a few countries in the world are worse than that. Now, the one area that we've published on that I think is pertinent here are the asymptomatics. We have published in the Annals of Internal Medicine 16 cohorts, and we have another paper coming out with much larger numbers where we try to cull all the data on asymptomatics together. And we find that 30 to 40% of people who get COVID never had symptoms. It was not discernible that they had COVID. Now, this is really important because if you're trying to develop a focused protection program and you have so many people, such a large proportion of 30 to 40% who don't ever even know they have an infection, which is in part why we have more than 60 million Americans by seropositive studies to project that over 60 million Americans have had COVID now. So this is a big issue because four series of people who had CAT scans of their lungs who were asymptomatic, half of them had the classic ground glass opacifications, consolidations of COVID. That is, it was internally hurting them, but they didn't know it. So they're asymptomatic at multiple levels, not just without symptoms, but with internal damage. And in fact, I've written about the heart sequela of COVID in Science. And indeed, the same thing has occurred. There's been young people, even sudden death in athletes, professional athletes, and young people, college athletes with myocarditis, they were asymptomatic. And in fact, a series in Germany of 100 people who underwent magnetic resonance imaging, 18 were asymptomatic, and 12 of those people had significant abnormalities in their heart magnetic resonance imaging, consistent with myocarditis or damage. So there's a big part of asymptomatic that, again, is not captured if you only focus on death. Now, as far as lockdowns, the L word, this evokes a lot of emotion because none of us want to have a lockdown. And I actually think they would be horrible. We have to resort to any lockdowns. And in fact, I don't believe we've ever had a real lockdown in the United States, because if you look at other countries in the world where lockdowns have been used, they've been enforced. They've been severe. And if people left their home, they would be either fined or even arrested in certain countries. So we have had lockdown lights in this country. Currently, there's only three states that have a stay-at-home. California, which is in really bad shape right now, where I live in Southern California, where, for example, in Los Angeles, hospitals are running out of oxygen. They have putting patients in the gift shop and in conference rooms. And that's during a stay-at-home order because the mobility hasn't changed from the pre-stay-at-home. That is, it's not being observed. It's not being adhered to. And the other two states that are using are North Carolina and Ohio. So there's hardly any of these lockdown lights, if you will, going on in the U.S., and we don't want them. You don't want them. I certainly don't want them. But there are other ways to do this, and a focused approach. Since focus is a word that's used in the Great Barrington Declaration. That is cluster busting, as was used in Japan. That is these events that we know are likely to be super spreaders, and this Pareto principle of 80% of infections occur from 20% of the people through these super spreader venues. And so there you have the idea of these gatherings like weddings and religious gatherings that are known and implicated for spread that need to be be on the vigilant about and trying to prevent crowds and certainly improving ventilation and other things that can avoid these super spreader events like occurred with the Biogen conference. Now, the point about biding time is important, that is protecting everyone and biding time, because we have seen during the 2020 year throughout the pandemic that the mortality reduction has been important. That is, by means of using proning, avoiding mechanical ventilators, using blood thinners in the right people, and using dexamethasone when there's early evidence of cytokine storm. There are many things that we can do to lower the mortality. Beyond that, we now have things like monoclonal antibodies to the virus that, when used early, can completely inactivate it, particularly in people who don't have any of their own intrinsic antibody response. And we can have the ability to see further mortality decrease as we employ newer therapies and hopefully roll out the vaccines in a high proportion of people. So what I'm proposing, in fact, is avoidance, total avoidance of lockdowns, even light lockdowns, but being very much an aggressive approach that has not been undertaken in the United States. Firstly, I note the omission of masks in the Great Barrington Declaration, and I certainly think that masks are a vital part. This is a respiratory virus. That's how it's transmitted, through droplets and aerosols. And so masks are essential, and the highest quality of masks, the better. And that's why I believe the government should distribute masks, as was originally planned in April by the U.S. Postal Service. 650 million masks were going to be sent, and that was shot down by the Trump administration. But sending out high-quality masks to every household should have rapid home tests to be able to determine if they have high viral load and are infectious. They've been ready since April, and they should be in every household. A large supply of these antigen tests that are very quick, within 15 minutes, some get down to less than 5 minutes, and they can establish if someone should stay home, should be isolated because they are potentially infectious. Moreover, we should be doing wastewater surveillance. We should have every individual through their phone or whatever access they have to the internet to be able to determine what risk level they are at. By wastewater surveillance, by digital sensors, picking up things like heart rate that we've published on, which is when it's elevated at rest in a cluster of people, it denotes the emergence of an early outbreak and can be thwarted and is being used, for example, in Germany throughout 600,000 people in the country to monitor COVID. So there are many things that we could do that we aren't doing, unfortunately. And lastly, I just want to say I do fully agree with your proposal. I believe you are in agreement with your colleague, Jay Bhattacharya, which is with respect to who should be vaccinated. And there I do agree that we indeed need to vaccinate the aged, like you, I think, have proposed with Jay. The Wall Street Journal op-ed that was published talked about ending lockdowns next month. I think that's way too optimistic. We now have a variant, the B117 variant of the virus, which is very concerning because it increases transmission. All the things that we're discussing now are becoming more challenging to avoid spread. So I don't believe that schools should be shut down, but I do understand that this is a multi-generation exposure when kids come home, kids exposed to teachers and universities. Colleges have used frequent testing, as has Slovakia, as has Liverpool, to test asymptomatics and block spread. And now that we have in Colorado this variant appearing, it's going to, within the matter of weeks and months ahead, become the dominant strain virus in this country, just as it has already been occurring in the UK. So our challenges are going to be formidable because we're not rolling out the vaccines as was projected. The Operation Warp Speed of the doses that were forecast are way off the mark. And so there is no chance that things are going to get better just in the next month, really. We have to be realistic about this. And we're looking at several months minimum from now. And we're looking at a much more challenging virus to be confronted. So that's a summary. I think there are some points of agreement, Martin. But I think there are some issues here that hopefully I've covered, at least in this opening remarks. I'm looking forward to your comments.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Topol. Dr. Kohldorf's resolution is, instead of the current lockdowns, we must better protect the old while letting the young live normal lives. So, Professor Kohldorf.
Thank you so much, Tom, and thank you, Eric, for participating in this and for your thoughtful comments to start off. So, if we look at this pandemic and what's happened during this year, our approach to this pandemic is the worst assault on the working class in half a century since segregation and since the Vietnam War. So what we essentially are doing, we are protecting young professionals who can work from home, people like lawyers, academics, scientists, journalists, while we are exposing older people at high risk that are in the working class, people who work as janitors, cab drivers, in supermarkets, in food processing plants, etc. We have really put the burden on this pandemic on those less affluent. And we can see that from graphs, for example, from Toronto. Before there was a lockdown in Toronto, there was about equal number of cases in all neighborhoods, affluent and less affluent. But then after the lockdown, you could see that the cases in the affluent neighborhoods patterned out, but it went continued to spike in the working class, less affluent neighborhoods. So we have sort of shifted a burden of this disease onto the less affluent working class people, while those of us who can work from home have been protected. In the same way as it's possible to shift the risk in that way, what we should have done instead and what we should still do is to shift the risk of infection from those that are less, from those that are more, to reduce the risk for those that are most at risk for mortality. So while anybody can get infected of COVID, there is more than a thousandfold difference in mortality. And there's also a big difference in serious complications from the disease. But if you look at mortality, there's more than a thousandfold difference. So that older people, for older people, this is a very serious disease, so much worse than annual influenza. On the other hand, for children, this is not a serious disease and it's less dangerous and the annual influenza for children. So there's that enormous difference. So in order to minimize overall mortality, we have to do a better job protecting old people. And that's half of the Great Barrington Declaration. And we have utterly failed doing that during this pandemic, both in the United States and most other countries. And there are actually very simple public health measures that can be done to protect older, vulnerable, high-risk people that has not been implemented. So half the Great Barrington Declaration is that we need to do a much better job protecting older, elderly people. For example, most mortality is in nursing homes because the people are old and they are frail. So it should be obvious that we should do testing of staff in nursing homes in a frequent way, at least three times a week, but maybe every day. And that can be done with these antigen tests, for example. We should have less, and in some nursing home that's being done, and that's good, but in other nursing homes it's not being done, and to me that's a scandal. The other thing, we have to have less staff rotation, because the more staff that a resident is exposed to, the more higher the risk is. So we should not allow staff rotation between nursing homes so that each staff person that only work in one nursing home, not multiple nursing homes. Also within nursing home, we should try to focus it so that each resident is exposed to as few staff as possible. Also, when somebody is testing positive in the nursing home, we have to isolate them and remove them to a different place so that they do not infect others. So there are multiple ways. Of course, there also has to be in the nursing homes things like hand hygiene and masks and those kind of things. But there are many things that we could do to protect nursing home residents better, which we're not doing. Another group of people are older people. And of course, the other thing is, since these are the highest risk in nursing home, those should be at the highest priority for vaccination, both the residents as well as the staff. They are not currently at the top of the list, which I think they should be. Another group of people are the old people who work at home, live at home. They should have help with grocery shopping, for example. There's no reason why they should be in a supermarket. And I see old people in the supermarket when I go there. We should have arrangements so that they can have food delivered. Another example are people who older people in their 60s or 70s who are still in the workforce, they need to be better protected. So if they can work from home, that's great, and they're already protected. But those who cannot work from home, because you can't work from home if you're a cab driver, for example, they should be allowed to have a 3 to 6 month sabbatical during the height of the pandemic, when the transmission is the highest, to protect them. And that could be done through different ways, social security, disability insurance, unemployment insurance, etc. It doesn't really matter from a public health perspective which of those methods are used. But there are ways that we can protect them who are high risk and still in workforce. The fourth group are the people living in multi-generational homes. And there, actually, the lockdowns have made things worse, because when we closed the universities, many students were sent home. And where do they live? Well, if you're in your 20s, then your parents might be in their 60s or even older, or there might be other older relatives there. So you're actually increasing the multi-generational homes by closing universities. So that was a huge mistake. It's better that if a student gets infected, it's better to get infected at university versus at home. So that was a big mistake. Also, if you live in a multi-generational homes, you're not, there's studies from Sweden that shows that you're not really into increased risk because of children in the multi-generational home. You're increased risk because of working age adults. And I think in Sweden, it was about a 70% or 60% increased risk in the study in Stockholm if you live with working age adults versus older adults. So they would also have to work from home, and then that's fine. If not, then maybe those older people could live with an older relative or neighbor or friend for a while, or we could make empty hotel rooms available for these to protect them. So there are many ways that we can protect the older people that we haven't utilized. At the same time, this idea of trying to suppress the disease by doing lockdowns or closing schools, universities, closing restaurants, closing business, and those things, that has utterly failed to protect the elderly. They have still gotten sick, and they have still got died. So this general attempt to sort of suppress the disease by protecting everybody has not worked to protect the old people. So that has been an utter failure of this lockdown strategy that has been implemented around the world. And we failed to do that. And we failed to implement just basic public health measures that we should have done a long, long time ago. And we still should do that. Of course, at this point, the vaccines are the most important way to do focused protection of the elderly. But we still have to continue. We still have to implement these other ones also, because vaccines are great, but they are not 100% protection. So vaccines are not enough. We have to do this other protection of the elderly as well. So that's sort of half part of the Great Barrington Declaration, that we should and could and can protect older people better. The other aspect is for younger people, for children and young adults, they have small risk from COVID-19, but they actually have very high risk from the collateral damage caused by the lockdowns. If you take children, for example, they have almost no risk from COVID. But not getting education is a serious negative consequence, and not just for the education, but also for their physical health and their mental health is deteriorating because of that, and their social development. So this is very serious, and we're putting a lot of burden on children. I think it's a society, and that should never happen. We should never put the burden of things on children. They are our future. And of course, it's especially damaging to working class children, because affluent families, they can afford to send their children to private schools, many of whom are open actually, or to have tutors, or to do post-schooling, or to do homeschooling more efficiently. So the children has really been hurt by these lockdowns. And I think if there's one thing that I would do immediately to change this in accordance with the Great Barrington Declaration, if I can only pick one thing, it would be to open all the schools immediately for in-person teaching. There's absolutely no public health reason to keep them closed. But also for young adults, the damaging from the collateral damage from the lockdowns has been severe. We know that the number of medical visits has plummeted. It went greatly down in the spring. It has rebounded a little bit, but not fully. We have still way below the normal levels of healthcare visits. And when people go to the doctor, they don't go there for the fun of it. They go there because they need some kind of treatment or prevention or something that will make them feel better and live longer. So, for example, the childhood vaccination rates have plummeted. And we have seen in some parts of the world that measles have outbreaks. Cardiovascular disease outcomes are much worse than before. People don't go to the hospital or to the doctor when they should. They don't get the preventive treatment they should. We have less cancer this year than most year, but that's not because there are less cancer. It's because they're not diagnosed. And if they're not diagnosed, we can't treat them, and then we'll have worse outcomes. So maybe somebody who didn't get their pap smear screening may now die 3 or 4 years from now instead of living another 15, 20 years. So these are collateral damages on health. And of course, mental health has deteriorated. Young adults in their 20s, many had 25% in June only had suicidal ideation. And that's just in 1 month, and it's usually in the single digit for the whole year. And opioid death have increased greatly in March, April, and May in the 25 to 44-year-old age group. These are severe consequences on other aspects of health. And one of the principles of public health is you cannot look only at one disease. You cannot only look at COVID-19 in this case. You have to look at all aspects of health. And this collateral damage is severe. We are starting to get numbers on it. We are bombarded with numbers from COVID-19 on a daily basis, but we are starting to get numbers also from these collateral damage from other diseases. And some of them are visible in 2020, but there are also many like cancers we don't really see this year, but we will see it in the years to come. Therefore, it's important that young people can live normal lives so that we don't get all this collateral damage. There's also other aspects like house evictions. In a way, that's an economic consequence, but that also has severe public health consequences. If somebody can't live, if they become homeless, that has enormous public health consequences. As scientists, we have to look at the whole world also. We can't just look at the United States. And in many of the developing countries, the lockdowns has caused starvation and malnutrition. And if children are malnutritioned as child, that has long-term health consequences throughout their life. And one estimate was that there were 10,000 extra childhood deaths from starvation every month during the pandemic. So those are very tragic and very sad consequences of the lockdowns that we have seen. Therefore, I think we have to do a better job protecting the old through vaccinations as well as through other ways. At the same time, we need to let children go to school, students go to universities, in-person teaching. I would like to let young people resume normal life and all the benefit of the past that in terms of their public health and their mental and physical health.
Okay, thank you, Professor Goldwater. I'm going to disappear into the background, let the two of you discuss things without my involvement. And of course, I'm not going to try to direct the discussion, although I would love to hear Dr. Koldorf address the morbidity issue that Dr. Topol brought up, but that's up to you gentlemen to decide. Dr. Topol, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Tom and Martin, for your points. Let me try to respond a few of them, and maybe we can get some back and forth here. You know, I think I can't underscore enough that even though there is less danger as we go down in age, there still is danger. And it's not just of dying, but even with dying, with 2 million children now having been infected with confirmed PCR testing, there's still infants, children who have died. There's hundreds of children in the United States who have had the multi-system inflammatory syndrome who have nearly died. But also there's the hospitalizations right now. If you look at who's in the hospital in the United States, 40% of the hospitalizations are in people younger than 65. And it's a lot of morbidity. And so, you know, again, it's issue about not just death, but less than death, serious morbidity. And those who are not in the hospital, of course, not being able to get back to work, who knows how many years that's going to take. Now, while we're on that subject of not knowing the future, you know, we should all agree this has been a very hard year for everyone on the planet, right? This has not been, even the countries that have prevailed, like New Zealand, Australia, Thailand, Taiwan, Vietnam, Japan. You know, there's a long list. There are Uruguay. You know, many countries have done very well in this throughout this pandemic. But I've talked to colleagues in some of these countries, and it's not easy. But obviously, there's been a strain on all mental health. But just to be clear, the review of suicides in the British Medical Journal showed no increase in suicide throughout the pandemic. And while you alluded to suicide ideation in one particular study, there's many studies that negate that it never resulted in people killing themselves during the pandemic. And that, in fact, is surprising, not just from the lockdown, but the loss of our vibrant, normal pre-pandemic life. So, you know, the idea of the schools, you and I both agree that we should have all the schools, all the universities open. And the problem with that is it's unguided. If we had the tests, if we had the rapid home tests, each morning, each child would have a test to know whether they should go to school. Each teacher, bus driver, all the staff would each know it's good to go to school today because they test every day, like you were alluding to, and I agree, in nursing homes, should be done every day. We have the means. We should have had these tests widely available back in April when they became validated. So the other thing you touched on about the danger, I couldn't agree more about supporting the elderly. And for example, 40% of the deaths in this country have been in nursing homes, which is just deplorable that that's occurred. But the idea that we can protect the elderly, which, you know, we failed, and have people do the food delivery, the gig jobs like Instacart and working for grocery stores, well, when the spread begets spread in the community because of all the asymptomatic infections, that's another way we can't protect the people that are bringing in deliveries of food and other things to the elderly. They could easily be infected. No less, you know, the networks involved with schools and other entities. The business issue of closing down businesses that are known to be associated with spread in zones where there's very high community spread, like restaurants, like bars, like gyms. These are focused approaches when things get tough, when things are escalating. What I wanted to ask you is when you go to the grocery store, like you mentioned, Martin, do you wear a mask?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And I wanted to respond a little bit to what Tom said about long COVID. So as with any infectious disease, there are people who have long-term consequences of COVID-19. That's also true, for example, from influenza. There are some people who, most people recover quickly, but there are some people who have long-term consequences of influenza. Now, I have not seen any study that shows that the long-term consequences from COVID is worse than the long-term consequences from influenza. I have heard anecdotal reports from physician friends that it's about the same, but those are just anecdotal reports, and I have not seen any thorough study to determine that the long-term consequences of COVID is worse than from influenza. Now, obviously, we do not know anything about what the long-term consequences are beyond, I guess, around 9 months by now, because there are very few people who had who were diagnosed by I guess it's about 10 or 11 months now. Very few people have been diagnosed for more than a year. So I think we don't know what the long, beyond the year consequences are from COVID. On the other hand, we do know the long-term consequences from lockdowns in terms of on cancer and mental health and those things that those are very severe. I'm very appreciative of two things that Eric is saying. One is that we should have and should do a better job protecting the elderly, because that's half of the Great Barrington Declaration. And it has sort of been very frustrating or disturbing to me that people will criticize the Great Barrington Declaration without acknowledging that we do have to do a much better job protecting the old through standard measures. And people say it can't be done. We know that it can't be done. We can do better testing. And what Eric says is correct. We should have these rapid home tests, or in this case, nursing home tests with antigen that the staff can take every morning when they come to work. and they will know the results in 15 minutes. That should be done there on a frequent basis. I also agree with Eric that these home tests should be available to everybody over the counter, because if I'm at home and maybe I want to visit an older relative, I want people to have be able to take those tests before they do that, because it's important for all people to have visits by friends and family. Otherwise, they will just sort of die from loneliness or deteriorate their health from loneliness. So it's important, and also it's important that nursing home residents has visitors from family and friends, so they can check up on them. How are they
right.
doing?
Right.
Is there some medical problem that needs attention? The purpose of having family and friends visiting is obviously social and so on, but it's also to check up on the how they're doing medically and maybe point out if there are problems. So it's very important to be for all the people to have visits, and having this rapid home test that somebody can take in the morning, that would be a huge, huge help for that. And if somebody's positive, well, when they're going to visit their grandparent, well, maybe they'll have to wait a few weeks and the cousin have to visit instead that week. So mm-hmm. People can do this type of arrangement. So that's also an area of agreement that Eric and I, that we have. I'm also very encouraged about the schools, that Eric wants schools open, as I said. And if you look, for example, at Sweden, so if you do want to look at schools from a scientific point of view, and I expect that Eric agrees with this, we have to look at the place where schools were open during the height of the pandemic, which was in Sweden during the spring, where school and daycare were open for everybody ages 1 to 15. And among the 1.8 million children in Sweden, there were exactly zero deaths from COVID during this time period. That doesn't mean that children do not die sometimes from COVID, because they do. Yes, that children die from the annual influenza, and it's very tragic, every child who dies, but the children are at lower risk from COVID-19 than they are from influenza. And in Sweden, of the 1.8 million children, there were some hospitalizations and some severe cases, but the number of hospitalizations were very small, I think about a dozen or so. So I'm really glad that we agree that the schools and the universities should be open for in-person teaching. And then I think the disagreements are actually probably less than 50%, because you seem to agree half of it, which is protecting the old elderly. And that's very encouraging, and schools should be open. And then we can sort of have a discussion about some of the other
lockdown
measures.
Yeah, I think we both agree that lockdowns need to be avoided. So I don't support them. I know you don't. But what we don't agree on, I think, is from the lockdowns that you've alluded to in some of your writings, that they've led to higher mortality. We don't know that. That's a long, the long term, we don't know, because just like we don't know about how long does long COVID go on, the effect of lack of vaccinations in children or cancer screening in adults or cardiovascular screening, we don't know. We'd have to look at that data at a subsequent time to know if collateral damage did lead to higher deaths, because a lot of your approach in this Great Barrington is, as I said, death-centric. So I think we should acknowledge that we don't have good evidence of that lockdowns, not that I support them, but a lot of the reason why, in the end of lockdowns, again, lockdowns, because of the libertarian views, any idea of having to wear a mask or having to have a lockdown, it isn't viewed favorably, and it feeds into that. But we don't know that it truly increases the death rate. But moreover, the idea that flu generates long flu, there's no data to support that. There are many series, one just published this week of 4,000 people, and also of physicians who've had COVID, a series that show that this is debilitating in many people. And as I've already mentioned, some people have serious heart involvement, and even without symptoms, half of the people who were screened with CT scans had significant lung abnormalities, which haven't yet cleared up, resolved. So we don't know the length. So this isn't at all like flu. And to try to suggest that COVID's like flu is really, I think, where we have a significant disagreement. But one thing we do agree on, I think, is actually very important and creative that I think we should just develop here in the op-ed, and I suspect you are supportive of this as well. Because we've had so many people who've had COVID infections, that we could get to a level of population immunity with vaccines faster. And the idea is that people who have an infection, have had an infection, wouldn't be in first in line to get the vaccine. The problem we have here, and I totally support that, and it isn't, by the way, a strategy, just like in the U.S., as you pointed out, it should be older people get vaccinated first. And that's not the way it's proceeding. That's the way it's moving in Israel very rapidly. A fourth of the people over 65 have already been vaccinated in Israel in a matter of simply days, really. We should be doing that here. But the problem we have is this prior infection diagnosis, because the serology may be negative after a matter of weeks or months. And the problem is what we really need is a neutralization antibody rapid test and say, if you're positive, if you have had a clear-cut infection and you have good response, immune response, then you don't need a vaccine right now. They need to be prioritized to the people where the supply is vital. And we could get to population level immunity much faster because we have this very large group of at least 60 million projected, you know, one-fifth of the American population that have been infected. So we agree about that. We just don't have the means to distinguish those who have had natural immunity. And one other point about that, the uncertainty of not being able to diagnose them. In the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine trial, there were 3% who had had prior infections when they checked their sera status after enrollment. And in the Moderna trial, 2.2% had COVID serology positive to the antigen, SARS-CoV-2 spike antigen. Now, the problem there is that the people in the placebo group in Pfizer trial went on and had reinfections, which was protected by the vaccine almost completely. So the point here is that natural immunity is not as good as, in many people, the vaccine-induced immunity. And my colleague here at Scripps, Dennis Burton, who chairs our immunology department, and I wrote about this superhuman immunity that has only been seen in one other virus, HPV, and now it appears to be the case with the mRNA vaccines, with this 95% efficacy and protection from reinfection. So just to point out here, Martin, we are in agreement that we could capitalize on the unfortunate spread of COVID throughout this country and in other places where it has spread broadly. But we don't have a good way of finding these people with a rapid test yet. And we also know that there's a gap between their natural immune response and what would be typically induced by the mRNA vaccine. So I wish we could go there, but I don't think we have a good solution at this point. I wonder what you think.
So I think you're right that people who we know had COVID naturally, a natural infection, they should not be on the top priority for the vaccine. We know some of them because of antigen tests, some because of PCR tests, and some of antibody tests. And of course, there are some people we don't know if they had it or not, and then we have to assume that they didn't have it. But those we know had it, they should not be prioritized for the vaccine. I think that we don't have any data of it, of course, but I doubt that the vaccine will give as good immunity as natural infection. That would be very unusual. So my guess is that the vaccine will not give as good immunity as natural infection. But of course, we don't know that because we don't have any long-term follow-up on the vaccine efficacy as of yet.
Yeah, well, that's what I was alluding to, at least from the trials, the vaccine trials. It appears that the protection from reinfection is better with the vaccine than in the placebo group. So it has that look. And also, if you look carefully at the phase 2 immune response studies of the mRNA vaccines, you see that in both Moderna and in the BioNTech, orders of magnitude higher neutralizing antibody, orders of magnitude higher than the typical convalescent person who's had COVID. So there are many indicators that the vaccine-induced immune response is superior to the natural infection. And as you say, it's unusual, and it's only been seen with one other virus, HPV before, but that's the way it looks. And that's what our essay in Nature Medicine points out. And in fact, more data has come out even since that was published last month to support that tenet. But, you know, I think we all want to get out of this pandemic. I mean, that's clear. And we want to be able to prevail. This would be a great step if we could do this, if we could capitalize on this very unfortunate broad spread that occurred in this country and, of course, in other parts of the world. I do agree with your point that we shouldn't look at COVID in isolation. We shouldn't look at the United States in isolation. The silly notion that we should have nationalism applied to our vaccination program when we're only going to get out of the woods when the predominant portion of the planet population, 70% or whatever percent, is vaccinated or protected. So we have to think much more broadly. I totally agree with you on those points.
Yeah, I think with the vaccines, we presume that we know that the vaccine is very effective for reducing symptoms, about 90%+ effective of that. So that's very good and very promising. What we don't know, have data from yet, is if vaccines reduce mortality. We presume that it does, because if it reduces symptoms, then we expect it will also reduce mortality. But we actually don't have data on that quite yet. Also, we presume that if there's less symptoms, there will be less transmission, so that vaccine will prevent transmission also. But we don't have any, the way that the studies was designed, we don't have any knowledge about that on the Pfizer vaccine either. So there are still a lot of uncertainties in terms of how much benefit the vaccines will give. But at this point, we know there will be some benefit, and we need to use it because it does provide protection. We don't know exactly how good the vaccine is at this point. It might be good, it might be great, we don't know. But eventually we'll find those things out.
I mean, the Moderna trial is being published today in the New England Journal. It shows 30 severe infections in the placebo group, zero severe infections in the treatment vaccine group. Also in the Moderna trial, they did do nasopharyngeal swabs. They did look at asymptomatic infections. More work needs to be done on that. But so far, both that work and the AstraZeneca Oxford studies have suggested that transmission will be reduced, that it does reduce shedding, that it does have mucosal immunity, at least in a significant proportion of people. Whether that's complete, obviously, is not likely, but at least it does look like there's going to be an effect of sterilization to some extent. But I think, you know, this has been a good discussion. I'm glad to have the chance to meet you, Martin, and to hear your logic about, you know, we have some differences. We agree to disagree. And I know your intentions are good and solid, as are your colleagues. And I hope that this has been a good vetting of the issues and, you know, where we disagree and also where a lot more work needs to be done.
Yeah, I think if one thing can come out of this discussion that is if we can all push for better protection of the old, both through the vaccines and the other means, I think that is so very critically important for public health. And for some reason has been forgotten. I think that's something we really, really have to push for much harder. And the other one is to get the schools and universities open. To me, that is, if we can get those two things, then that would be absolutely huge and absolutely fantastic. And it would be so important for the children and the young among us to be able to go to school in person. So if we can get those things, then I think we are, and with the two of us at agreement on that, if we can get more of a consensus among everybody on those things, then I think that would be huge. Enormous benefit to society, and especially among those less affluent and the working class, who has really taken the huge burden, and especially the working class in the inner cities, because as with many infectious diseases, usually urban areas are harder hit than rural areas, because they are natural things. So therefore, there's been sort of a double whammy against the working class in the inner city, because they are both urban and they are less affluent working class. So they are really taking a double whammy on the way that we strategy that we have taken through this pandemic.
Well, I think I would say the conversation has come to a natural conclusion. So I would like to thank both of you. This is a model for scholarly discussion. So my thanks to Professors Kulldorff and Topol. I'll put links to both these gentlemen in the description of the video as well as on the show notes page. Thank you very much again.
Thank you very much, Tom and Martin. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you, Tom. I really appreciate it.
And Happy New Year.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.